Atheist Nomads, episode 319, The Myth of the Christian Nation, with Andrew Seidel.
The podcast you're about to listen to includes cursing and talking about hoo-haws. Please be advised.
Welcome to another episode of Atheist Nomads. I am Dustin, and in a little bit, we'll be joined by Andrew Seidel from the Freedom From Religion Foundation. It was a really good discussion, and I do want to apologize that this episode is late, but I did warn you, so you can't hold that against me. We went up to the cabin for Labor Day weekend and had a good time there with family and, you know, got a little bit of extra time off. So that was also nice and relaxing and, you know, talking fishing and a little trip to Yellowstone with hiking up to Fairy Falls and Kylie falling asleep on me in the hammock. And yeah, it was pretty good. It was and a lot of good beer. But if you want to come up to the cabin, you can. Camp Nomad will be taking place in Island Park. We have moved the weekend back 1 week, which has allowed more people to come, which is good. It will be the weekend of September 20-22, so it's really just about 2 weeks away. If you are anywhere near Island Park, Idaho, which is just below Yellowstone National Park, well, actually, it's to the west of Yellowstone National Park, but you have to drive due north to get into the park because of mountains. But anyway, if you live anywhere near there, I highly recommend you come. We have people coming from as far away as Saskatchewan for this. We're going to do a live episode recording for those who attend. We'll have barbecue. We'll have relaxation. We'll have conversation. We'll have a day trip up to Yellowstone. It is going to be awesome. I highly recommend as many people as possible come. I would be very happy if we have to put a bunch of people out in the tents. So yes, please do come. Please RSVP on the website using the feedback form or shoot us an email at contact@atheistnomads.com. And we will have more information about the itinerary next week. I am holding off on feedback since this was a pre-recorded interview that this week's episode is mainly filled with. But we have plenty of feedback for next week. So be on the lookout for that and feel free to send us more. We always love it. And we also got a donation, but I will also be covering that next week. So again, thank you. Richard, I'm going to say thank you now, but you'll get the big thank you next week with Lauren as well. But before we get into the interview, there was a relevant news story that came out in the last couple weeks that holy shit, no, this one was just going around again. It's an old one. It's from 2015. Oh, wow. Okay, I've been hanging on to this anyway. But it's still relevant. I saw it floating around on the internet somewhere, and it was a survey that PRRI did asking people if America is a Christian nation. And the three options were America has always been and is currently a Christian nation. America was a Christian nation in the past, but is not now. And America has never been a Christian nation. Unfortunately, only 14% of respondents responded America has never been a Christian nation. But more importantly, only 35% said that it is and always has been a Christian nation. That means nearly 60% of respondents believe that the U.S. is at least at present not a Christian nation. So the Christian nationalists are pushing a minority agenda of roughly 35% of the population, which matches up pretty closely with the bottom end of what Trump's polling numbers are. But at this point, we're going to go ahead and move right on into the interview. And we are now joined by Andrew Seidel, who is a constitutional attorney and the director of strategic response at the Freedom From Religion Foundation. His book, The Founding Myth, Why Christian Nationalism is Un-American, came out in May. Andrew, welcome to Atheist Nomads.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
So I've heard you talk about your book on a couple other podcasts. Probably most notably would be Opening Arguments, where you and Andrew totally geeked out for quite a while.
we tend to do that. It's obscene.
The legal geekery can get pretty thick between you two.
You should see it when we go out for dinner or drinks or something. When I'm in DC, it's even worse.
But you started working on this in law school, correct?
Pretty much, yeah. This actually, for me, this started as a law review article that got really out of hand. You know, there's these a few decisions that the Supreme Court made in 2005 regarding some Ten Commandments monuments.
Okay.
One was in Kentucky in a couple courthouses up there, and one was at the Capitol grounds in Austin, Texas, the state capitol. And they struck down the Kentucky displays of the Ten Commandments, and they upheld the Austin, Texas display of the Ten Commandments, which is very weird. And they did it on the same day, and they did it in 5-4 decisions. So it's very, very strange. And I really wanted to look more closely at it. And when I was reading the opinions, I was struck by this line that said, you know, something along the lines of the Ten Commandments informed our legal system. They are part of our legal history. And I thought, well, that can't be true. Can it? And so I wanted to actually just kind of examine that claim. That was the only thing that I intended to do. And I was going to just write it as a law review article. And that's where this started. And then the more I dug into it.
14 years ago.
No, not 14 years ago. Okay. So that was, it was when I was getting my LLM, which was in 2010. So that was when I really first started it. But the opinions were in 2005. In 2005, I was a Grand Canyon tour guide, so I was not interested in the law.
And for our listeners, LLM, that's Master of Letters?
That's a Masters of Law, legal letters. I actually don't even know what it stands for. And so I got that after my JD, which is the typical law school degree.
Right. I did that you get the doctorate and then you get the master's.
It's a little weird. It's a specialization for law. So, for instance, if you want to be a tax attorney, you have to get an LLM. I got it because, I was doing a fellowship at the University of Denver, in international environmental law, and as attached to the fellowship was it was through this LLM program, so I got a scholarship and did it that way.
Okay.
And I was teaching at the environmental law clinic, and I wrote this incredibly esoteric handbook on shadow reporting under international human rights instruments that literally nobody has read. It's not published. It was published by the clinics, you know, as a PDF. So not a real book.
That sounds fascinating, though.
I mean, it's the word shadow that makes it sound cool. It's really not.
How to use international conventions to not die.
So, right? I mean, basically, you know, under all the international conventions, you as a country are supposed to self-report how you're doing with meeting the requirements of the convention. And first of all, none of the countries report on time. Everybody's decades late in some cases. But NGOs, non-governmental organizations, nonprofits, civil rights groups have taken to issuing their own reports. Amnesty International is a good example of this. These are called shadow reports, which are they're based in the country or they're reporting on the country's progress with meeting the standards in these international instruments. And so I was kind of putting together sort of like a how-to book. Like if FFRF, the organization I work for now, wanted to report on how the United States was doing with the religious liberty standards in ICCPR, for instance, it would give you a basis to at least start and get moving down that road.
Okay.
Super niche.
Yeah.
And again, nobody's read it. So.
Right. Okay.
I had to write the clinic the other day. Well, I mean, this was a couple of years ago now to actually get a copy of it because you can't find it anyway.
All right. So you started in 2010 digging into this shift in American politics.
Absolutely. I mean, really, I started digging into this claim. You know, everybody's kind of heard the Christian nation claim. And the Ten Commandments aspect of that is deeper than just whether or not we're a Christian nation. It really gets to that underlying question, which was the United States founded on Christian or Judeo-Christian principles, like the Ten Commandments. And so the more I kind of investigated this law review article on the Ten Commandments, the more I came to formulate that question and investigate it with other claims. So, for instance, the things like In God We Trust and One Nation Under God, the idea that Jesus, you know, died for our sins. The golden rule, the fact that the founders were all deists, or they were all atheists, or they were all Bible-believing Christians. So, you know, all the different claims that are out there, and how they sort of all really tied in at their most basic level into this central question, which is, did Judeo-Christian principles positively influence the founding of the United States? And so, rather than just focusing on the Ten Commandments, I branched out into all these different things. So the Ten Commandments form one big part of the book. The mottos, those phrases, those idioms form another part. The basic Judeo-Christian principles that you can pull from the Bible, things like the Golden Rule, things like vicarious redemption through human sacrifice, hell, all that different stuff was another part. And then I deal sort of with more of the history, the Founding Fathers, the Declaration of Independence, our colonial history in yet another part of the book. So it's kind of those four basic parts was how I ended up organizing the answer or the investigation of this one question: did Judeo-Christian principles influence the founding, positively influence the founding of the United States?
Okay, I think a good starting point at this, right, for this would be, what does Judeo-Christian principles even mean?
Yeah. I mean, it's such a good question. It's obviously, for this investigation, it was a fundamental question. It's harder to answer than you would think. And it's actually, I think that is one of the reasons that nobody's written a book like this before. Nobody's done that investigation, is because that term is so vague and nebulous that it actually insulates the underlying claim that we are founded on Judeo-Christian principles from scrutiny and criticism.
Right. When you make up a bullshit term.
Yeah. It makes it easy to defend.
Right. Because how do you argue against something that isn't even definable?
Exactly. It's a nailing jello to a wall problem. And, you know, so what I did was really look at a lot of the language that politicians have used when they're talking about Judeo-Christian principles. I mean, there's also the inherent contradiction in the term, not even Judeo-Christian principles, just Judeo-Christian. I mean, Jews are Jewish because they reject Jesus as the Savior. Christians are Christian because they accept. I mean, it's a fundamental contradiction in that term. And I actually go over in the book, The Founding Myth, how that term came to be. And it's pretty much a post-World War II term that was invented because saying something like we were founded on Christian principles sounded really ominous in the wake of World War II.
Right, because the Nazis were explicitly and actively pushing a Christian agenda.
And it is also what happened to the Jewish people was so just horrific that you don't want to people wanted to err on the side of caution, so they accepted this inherent contradiction in the terms to avoid seeming like Nazis, which is a bit of an oversimplification. But the term itself, Judeo-Christian principles, I mean, you kind of have a vague idea. These are the things that you can get from the Bible. What are the principles that are central to the Bible? The Ten Commandments, which are supposedly central to Christianity. The various things that Jesus preached.
As you include Jesus, then there's no Judeo part.
Exactly. I mean, and yes, and it's just a contradiction that I accepted for the purposes of the book. I pointed out at the beginning, I say this is ridiculous, and then I say, but this is what they're claiming, so we're going to go ahead and roll with it, and I'm going to destroy it anyway.
All right.
So that's what I actually do. I walk through. Part two is all the different principles that you can really pull out of the Bible that are central to Christianity or Judeo-Christianity. I mean, and hell is actually a good example of, hell is properly a Christian principle. Mm-hmm. It doesn't appear in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew Bible, in the way that it appears in the New Testament, in the Christian Bible.
It actually doesn't appear in the New Testament the way most Christians think it does.
No, in the Old Testament, it's called Sheol. It's like sort of this place. It's sort of an afterlife type place. It looked more like Greek than anything, really. Mm-hmm. Like the heroes wanted to go there. Even, I mean, Job was like, please get me to Sheol. I'm so tired of this suffering. But in the New Testament, it is this place of eternal torment, suffering, heat, and fire. Those are the two things that you get from the New Testament reading about hell. It is fire. It is eternal heat. And eternity, and it encapsulates that problem with Judeo-Christian, but it also encapsulates the problem with the overall claim that we're founded on Judeo-Christian principles, because hell is an infinite punishment for a finite crime. And it is also, by any stretch of the imagination, cruel and unusual. And our Constitution absolutely prohibits cruel and unusual punishment. And while it does allow for the death penalty, at least in theory, you know, that itself, we can kill you and that's all we can do to you. We can't torture you for all eternity. So to me, there's kind of this fundamental conflict between this central Christian principle, hell, and our Constitution. It's very explicit. It's right there in the Eighth Amendment. I mean, the Supreme Court held that being locked in jail with a 5-pack-a-day smoker was cruel and unusual punishment. And if being in jail with a smoker is cruel and unusual, you can imagine what the fire and brimstone of hell for all eternity would be like. So there's this fundamental conflict between the two systems. And that's what I try to get at in the book. So the answer to that question, did Judeo-Christian principles positively influence the founding of the United States, is no, they did not. We were not founded on Judeo-Christian principles, and it's a good thing, because those principles are fundamentally and thoroughly opposed to the principles and values on which the United States was built.
Right, because if you go with the model of the conventional Christian view of hell, then the most severe punishment wouldn't be execution.
Exactly.
It would be prolonging your life with the best health care possible while torturing you continuously.
Mm-hmm. It's terrifying. Terrible idea.
Nobody's ever done that. Well, okay, there's been a few one-offs, but at least like no government's really done that.
I mean, were it to be able to challenge that in court, it would, in the U.S. court, it would absolutely be declared unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no doubt about that. And so that's really what I try to do throughout the book, is I look at those principles that are central to Judeo-Christianity, and then compare them to our founding principles. And in almost every instance, there's just this fundamental disagreement. It's irreconcilable. And so, the punchline is that the two systems differ and conflict to such a degree that, to put it bluntly, Christianity is un-American.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the argument that I make. That's the founding myth. It is the truth. You know, I kind of didn't expect to arrive at that conclusion when I started writing the book, to be honest. Even when I started writing the Law Review article, I thought I was going to have to concede all this influence when I got to, do not kill, do not steal, that kind of stuff. But it turns out, no.
Yeah. Well, and like this would have, and I think it was like back up around episode 4 or 5, and we're now well over 300 episodes in.
Oh, wow.
Did one on Is America a Christian Nation? And one of the points that I made in that episode was, if you look at the way the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, all the founding documents are written, they don't appeal to a higher power. And if you look at treaties between the U.S. and Christian countries, there were specific formulations that were used to identify a Christian monarch. And the founding fathers knew how to write Christian governance, and they didn't.
Absolutely. I mean, and the Constitution, to me, is the pinnacle of this, right? I mean, it begins, "We the people."
Mm-hmm.
And those three words were a revolution in themselves, right? I mean, every other constitution to that point began with an invocation of a supernatural God. And that was rejected by the founders. We do have a godless constitution. There's no mention of a deity or the supernatural in there. And the only mentions of religion are exclusionary, you know, banning religious tests for public office. And then in Article 6, and then the First Amendment, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. They could have added Jesus or Christ or Christianity into it. There were many people who wanted to when they actually made the framework, the Constitution, public, and it was going through the ratification process. There were a number of citizens who were clamoring and saying, "Look, this doesn't have God. We can't ratify it." And still, they stuck by their guns and they won on that. We were the first nation to separate state and church. We invented the separation of state and church. And I mean, this is something that every American ought to be proud of, ought to be fighting for. You know, we shouldn't be papering it over with these myths about being a Christian nation or about Judeo-Christian principles.
Well, and like the 30 Years' War, granted being about 100, 150 years prior, was a war specifically over Christianity. And one of the end results of it was establishing a particular kind of freedom of religion where the prince got to choose. And you were free to be whatever religion your prince belonged to. Nobody had a concept of allowing actual average citizens to pick on their own.
No, they didn't. And this is something I touch on in some of the colonial chapters, specifically regarding the Pilgrims and Puritans up there in Massachusetts. You know, we love to tell this story in America that the Pilgrims came here seeking religious liberty, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not true. It's lovely to think that that's the case, but it's fundamentally not true. They came, they were fleeing religious persecution.
Yes.
But that's not the same as coming to seek out and establish religious liberty for all. They got here and they set up theocratic governments immediately, and they enforced their religious law with their secular government. And it's even worse when you look at the path they traveled. You know, they were in the Netherlands, in Holland, not in England. They fled England and went to Holland, which was at the time the most liberal country on earth. They could have worshipped however they wanted. And in fact, the Pilgrims were. They were the Pilgrims' fathers. They were losing followers. People were leaving the faith because they had all this freedom. And so the fathers said, look, we got to get the hell out of here. We got to get to a place where we can enforce our religious law, or we're not going to have a congregation left. So they got on their boat, went to America with a quick stop in England, in Plymouth. So,
yeah.
I mean, this isn't a fun, popular American myth, but it's a myth nonetheless.
Yeah, and when they stopped in Plymouth, they picked up one of my ancestors.
Really? Which one?
Edward Doughty.
No, I know a few of them, but that name doesn't ring a bell.
He wasn't a leader. He was the person in court at the Plymouth colony. He was in court the most out of anybody there. most of it was him getting sued by his father-in-law or brother-in-law.
Oh, very nice.
But he was quite the scoundrel.
That's excellent. that's a lot of fun. Annie Laurie Gaylor, FFRF co-president, also can trace her lineage back to the Mayflower. And she's very, very proud to say that, you know, it was not all religious folks on the Mayflower. There were a few. There was the saints. Mm-hmm. Her ancestor was not a saint, which she is very proud to declare.
My ancestor was an indentured servant of one of the adventurers.
There you go. So probably not a saint either.
Yeah.
All right.
So we get through the colonial period, and you know, at the time the Constitution was written, the various states, some of them were explicitly Christian.
Yeah, they were. Yeah, I mean, so, you know, and if you go back far enough, you can kind of say that all the colonies had an established church because really they were all part of the British Empire, which had the established Anglican Church, which the king was the head of. And he also, you know, gave charters to the various little colonies before they became sort of colonies that we know of as states, the 13 different ones. And actually, when you get that far, not all of those had established churches. New Jersey didn't. I don't think Pennsylvania did. Rhode Island did not, in the sense that the state government aligned itself with one church. But nine of them did. And after the federal government, the United States government took on this new invention, this secular government, this separating state and church, this American experiment, the states looked at it and said, this is really working out well. And each one of them began to disestablish their churches. Leading up through, I think it was 1834, I believe, was the last one. I think it was Massachusetts was the last one to disestablish. But to me, that's a fascinating piece of evidence for the idea that secular government, that there, it's a perfect piece of evidence to say that there is no such thing as freedom of religion without a government that is free from religion.
You
know,
right.
And it is the fact that they disestablished over, I think it was less than 50 years is absolutely striking.
Oh, yeah. And that may seem really slow by modern appearances. But when you consider the time period and how few people actually could vote.
Yeah.
That was ridiculously fast.
Oh, no. I mean, yeah. And it really was amazing, the amount of change that they pushed into those few years.
All right. So looking at the modern moves, when did this modern Christian nationalism really appear on the national stage?
So, I mean, Christian nationalism is, you know, in my mind, it is the biggest threat facing America today. I mean, that is the reason that I wrote The Founding Myth. And for people that don't know, Christian nationalism is this idea that the United States was founded as a Christian nation, that were based on Judeo-Christian principles. But more importantly, that we've strayed from that foundation. Mm-hmm. And Christian nationalists use the language of return and getting back to our religious roots to justify all manner of just awful right. public policy today. I mean, the immigration ban, the move of the embassy, the child separation policy at the border was justified using Romans 13. So this
State Department group on natural law.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. And I'll say FFRF, we saw that early on. We heard from some of our contacts on Capitol Hill that was happening. So, you know, that caught fire in the news around July 4th, July 7th, mm-hmm. somewhere in there. And we submitted a FOIA request to find out everything we can about that more than a month before that. So we're definitely keeping an eye on Mike Pompeo's attempt to redefine rights as God-given rights, which is just crushing. And very threatening to the idea of human rights, especially as we were talking about with some of those international agreements before. But to get back to your original question, you know, when did Christian nationalism start? There's kind of always been a thread of Christian nationalism running through American history, but beginning kind of around the 1830s in the lead up to the Civil War, you start to really see it, and it waxes and wanes, but it has never seized power in any serious way until Donald Trump. The number one indicator, the best indicator of somebody who was a Trump voter in the 2016 election was not their race. It was not their political affiliation, despite Republicans voting for him in overwhelming numbers, or their religion, despite evangelicals voting for him in overwhelming numbers. Not race, not being a racist. It was thinking that the United States was founded as a Christian nation. If a person thought, yes, we were founded as a Christian nation, that was the best indicator that they would vote for Donald Trump in 2016. He rode a wave of Christian nationalism into the most powerful office in the history of the world. And that was something that we have never seen.
So then was this, because the moral majority in the 80s and 90s, they were mm-hmm. definitely seemed to be kind of pushing this kind of of an agenda.
Absolutely.
And then it seems to have shifted to being mainstream Republican politics by the mid-90s. Has it just been like slowly growing like a cancer?
I don't think that's an unfair description. You know, it has been on the fringes, and you tend to see it when conservative politicians want to excite their base. So you often see it, or often saw it, during primaries. And that, you know, in the beginning of the book, I really try to explain a lot of where this came from and exactly really hone in on what this is and where it comes from. And a lot of, I was realizing as I was doing this research that a lot of the Christian nationalist rhetoric that I was quoting or citing to was coming from the primaries. And so, you know, they were using it to excite a certain group of people, but not really ever following through on it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of where the shift with Trump and Pence has occurred too.
Yeah. So, right. Because they actually continued pushing it all the way through to the election and continuing into horrifying policies.
Yeah, I mean, they've certainly not stopped. And if anything, Trump has gotten more adept at employing the Christian nationalist rhetoric. He was a bit clumsy with it at first because it was unfamiliar to him. A lot of the talking points were unfamiliar. But he trots them out with regularity now. I mean, and everybody listening has heard them. You know, in America, we don't worship government. We worship God. We are one nation under God. In God we trust. Our founding fathers prayed at the Constitutional Convention. It says God in the Declaration of Independence four different times. These are all things that Trump repeatedly says in speeches. These are part of his stump speeches, and especially if he's before any type of conservative or religious crowd, he always pivots to these talking points.
And yeah, they're all wrong. Yeah.
I go over every single one of them in the book. In The Founding Myth, I actually debunk every single one of his anemic talking points, every single one that I just mentioned.
Man, I think one of the best examples on it was Pence's commencement address at Liberty University.
Yeah, Liberty University has been a bastion for these two. He gave another one, I want to say, I don't know if it was Hilldale College. He gave a really terrible speech there, too. Mm-hmm. Pence did. I wrote an article for that entitled Probing Pence, where I sort of walked through some of his more egregious distortions.
Yeah. All right. So how can we combat this?
I mean, that's the $1 million question. And first, I also think that is what makes the founding myth different, because previous books have offered this gentle correction to the Christian nationalists. They, you know, say things like, well, here's what history actually tells us. Here's what the founders actually meant. Here is what the founders actually said, if you read their whole quote, or if you read it in context. And they kind of leave it at that. But really, correction is not enough.
Right. Otherwise, this is a movement that is trying to undo women's rights, undo gay rights, undo basic minority civil rights, and rewrite history.
Yeah. And correction is not enough because facts are not enough. Otherwise, we would not have a President Trump.
Right.
pointing out errors is insufficient. So I do that in the book, absolutely. But then I take the next step. This book goes on the offensive. It is an assault on the Christian nationalist identity. Not only are Christian nationalists wrong, their beliefs and identity run counter to the ideals on which this nation was founded. They are un-American. And that is the central argument of the book. And what I'm really trying to do is give our side better arguments, because we've had the facts on our side and we're not winning with those. We need better arguments. And it's not enough to simply rely on logic and reason. We also have to hit them where it hurts. I think one of the best ways that we do that is by reclaiming the American identity. And that is absolutely what I'm seeking to try to do in this book. And there are a few Christian nationalists out there that I'm sure will be convinced by this. I've talked to a few people who are surprised by a lot of the content in the book, and you know, wow, I have to rethink some things. But really, I'm writing for the progressive Americans, the secular Americans, the left, that needs to have better arguments that we can employ when fighting Christian nationalism. And for the middle section of the country, mm-hmm. to try to explain to them that this is Christian nationalism is an existential threat. It is a threat. It is the biggest threat to a government for the people, of the people, and by the people that we have ever seen. And if we do not confront it head on and push it back to the fringes from whence it came, we're going to lose our democracy. I'm sure that sounds hyperbolic to a few of your listeners, but it is the absolute goddamn truth.
Well, man, just recently McConnell crammed through, was it 13 successful lifetime appointments to the courts?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And a lot of these judges are Christian nationalists, and it is already impacting the decisions they're making, especially when you look at Justice Gorsuch and Justice Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court. I mean, the decision that came down in June in the American Legion versus the American Humanist Association case, which was this Bladensburg cross case. It centered around a 40-foot tall concrete cross on government property, maintained at government expense, hundreds of thousands of dollars spent to maintain this cross. This is a symbol of Christian nationalism. And we mm-hmm. we would never let a symbol of white nationalism stand on public land, but this Supreme Court decided that this symbol of Christian nationalism was absolutely appropriate to stand, and it did so solely on the basis of history. It elevated history above legal principle. And I have to believe that if we had been better at deploying the arguments in the founding myth, we might have been able to head this off. I mean, you know, we absolutely tried to do that in the briefs that we submitted to the court. We weren't litigating this case or representing any of the parties, but at the Supreme Court, you can submit what are called friend of the court briefs, amicus briefs, mm-hmm. and we did do some of that. But, you know, I have to believe that if we had done a better job of fighting for our history, reclaiming our history, reclaiming what it is to be an American, that the court could not have decided the case the way it did, because it would have been, there would have been no veneer of respectability on it, because the history is so bad and so flawed.
I'm in Boise, Idaho, and we have a cross up on Table Rock up above our city. And from almost anywhere in town, you can look up and see that cross. It was put up on public property, but the city did a
land swap,
illegal land trade of mm-hmm. 10 square feet, and that's now private property.
Yeah, that used to be the popular way to do that. We actually successfully challenged a few of those land swaps as well, because they were so very clearly meant to keep the appearance of the cross as a government symbol.
Mm-hmm.
But they were notoriously hard even before that.
Yeah, and when you see that, it sends a very clear message. And, you know, if you've got the entrance into your city is a giant cross that you have to drive by on public land, that is a very clear message as to who's in charge.
Yeah, that, I mean, it absolutely is. And that is exactly what it is intended to do. I mean, part of the reason that the Supreme Court upheld the cross is they said, look, yeah, sure, it's a Christian symbol, but it's also a secular symbol, which is nonsense. It's absolute nonsense. Of course it is a Christian symbol. It was put up because it's a Christian symbol. It was defended as vigorously as it was because it's a Christian symbol. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's not the first time courts have done things like this. The reason that In God We Trust has been upheld on our money and as our national motto is because, according to courts, it has lost through rote repetition all religious significance, which is mind-boggling. A phrase that only has religious significance, right? Mm-hmm. We trust in a supernatural being. The courts are now saying is not religious, and the hypocrisy of it is laid bare when you point to something else. Like, imagine the court saying, okay, John 3:16, you evangelicals have said it so much, it has lost all religious significance now. Or praying the rosary, sorry, Catholics, that it has lost all religious significance, you've done it too much, right? the outrage would be immediate and yeah. justifiable, right? Because a secular court has no business saying that a very clearly religious symbol or religious phrase is not religious. Put simply, the court does not have the power to do that. In the Federalist Papers, Alexander Hamilton was kind of exploring the differences between the English government and the new proposed federal government. And he was talking about the executive branch, but it still applies here. He wrote that we have no particle of spiritual jurisdiction. And that's absolutely right here. And so to me, it's the Christian hypocrisy of In God We Trust and of these crosses is just, it's so palpable when you see it too. So they're not just unconstitutional. They're also monuments to Christian hypocrisy.
Right. And how are Christians not horribly offended by that?
They should be. And to their credit, I will say this, I did a broad generalization in my last comment, but there were Christians that submitted briefs in the Bladensburg case saying, yeah, you can't do what you're about to do. You can't say that this is a secular symbol. This is absolutely a religious symbol. It is our most sacred religious symbol. You do not have the power. You do not have the right, Supreme Court, to say that it is not religious. And the Supreme Court did it anyway.
It's hypocrisy and it's blasphemy.
Yeah, it is. But the Christian nationalists don't care,
right?
Because they get to put their symbol up on land, up on the public land, on government land, and proclaim to the world that, yes, this is a Christian nation. They get, in the end, what they are seeking, which is to further align the American identity with their religion. So that to be an American is to be a Christian. To be a Christian is to be an American. Right. That yeah. is the goal. And then eventually they're doing it right now. They're going to rewrite our laws to reflect that, so that Christians are this favored political class and everybody else is second class citizens. That's what their goal is. That is slowly what's happening. It's what I'm fighting here at the Freedom From Religion Foundation every single day.
Yeah. And now that this is Supreme Court precedence, that if it's old, it's not a constitutional violation. How are they going to use that to further move things in their favor?
I mean, we're already seeing it happen. You know, it's not there. The Supreme Court said that this applies to, they didn't limit it to just displays, but they narrowed it down to displays. So they didn't say that this applies everywhere. But displays, government prayer, things like this. But what's going to happen, and what is already happening, is the other side is going to say, no, it doesn't just apply to those. It applies to everywhere. And there's no legitimate reason why you can say it only applies to religious displays and not all these other things that we are trying to do here. And it is... Compare that with the stacking of the federal judiciary that you already mentioned that mm-hmm. McConnell has so successfully done, and the fact that a solid proportion of those judges are overt Christian nationalists, and we are in for a real rough time. Okay, yeah. I don't want to scare everybody. So let me say this too. It sucks right now, but what you are seeing right now is Christian nationalism. The religious right, whatever phrase you want to attach to them, and I would encourage everybody to call them Christian nationalists, because everybody understands what that is immediately and how scary it is, even if they don't quite grasp the full reach of it. Christian nationalists are raging against the dying of their privilege.
Yeah.
Right? Evangelicals are getting up on Sunday mornings, they're going to their mega churches, and instead of seeing young, smiling faces in the pews, they're seeing empty seats. Right.
Mm-hmm.
They can read the demographic studies as well as we can. And what this is them doing as much damage and seeking to codify the privilege that they have before it is impossible, before it is yanked away from them. And they're doing a massive amount of damage right now, but they are not going to succeed fully. I mean, the only question is how much damage are they going to do and how long is it going to take us to recover? But they are going to get booted out of power. They are going to get booted out of the courts, too. It's just a question of how long it's going to take us to recover from the damage they've done.
So that also assumes that they aren't successful in furthering and getting better at very targeted gerrymandering and disenfranchising.
It assumes a lot
because there are plenty of historical examples of a motivated minority gaining absolute power using democratic processes.
Of course. I mean, the Electoral College is a reasonable example, not of absolute power and not of a huge minority, but it's an example of that too. I mean, the Three-Fifths uh-huh. Clause in the Constitution is an example of that as well. I mean, My previous attempt at cheerleading is predicated on the assumption that we do not, that our democracy does not fail entirely, which, you know, and when you throw in everything that is happening, including the gerrymandering that you can politically gerrymander now, according to the Supreme Court, you know, all these different things that are happening, that's not a given. So I guess I should say, assuming we survive intact.
All right. So aside from getting Christian nationalists out of power as quickly as possible while we still can, how can we try to fight this?
Yeah,
I'm sure it has to be in the courts. The voting booth and the courts are the options we have.
Yeah, I mean, and the courts are not even going to be that great. I mean, there are a number of different things that people can do. I mean, first is buy the book and understand the arguments in it. Join groups like the Freedom From Religion Foundation. You know, we are dedicated to keeping state and church separate, to fighting for the rights of atheists and non-believers, to educating the public about what it is to be a non-believer in the United States. And if you don't like FFRF, you know, join one of the other organizations out there. The ACLU, Americans United, American Humanist Association, American Atheists, Center for Inquiry, there's a ton. If you can, join them all. And I want to be clear that it's not just important to donate, that is huge, but it really is critical to join them as a member. And the reason for that is that when we go into a congressional office and say we represent 30 people or 300 people or 3,000 people, or when I write a letter to a school district that's got a teacher that's forcing kindergartners to pray before they walk down to lunch, as I had to do a few weeks ago. Ooh. And I say I represent 20 people in this state, or 200 people in this state, or 2,000 or 20,000 people. It makes a big difference. It's not just financial resources we need. We need you to join your voice with ours to give us the influence that we need to be able to stop these kind of things. And you know, we're at a disadvantage, our side and our movement, because we are unwilling to engage in the politics of fear and the fear mongering that comes natural to Christian nationalism. And we won't lie to people about what's happening, whereas they will. The myth of Christian persecution here in the United States is how they've done such a phenomenal job of building these massive fundraising apparatuses. So, I mean, one of the big things that people can do is to join up these groups. I would really also encourage everybody to get involved in politics, to run for office. I know that there are a lot of your listeners who hear me say that, and they probably think, well, I could never run for office. I mean, what are my qualifications? I couldn't do that. I'm not qualified. Look at the people in office right now. Mm-hmm. You are absolutely qualified to be a public official. Get out there, do it. Run for school board. I mean, run for county executive, run for city council. And, you know, this is something that the moral majority, the religious right, now the Christian nationalists, did very, very well in the 70s and 80s. They put a massive amount of resources into mobilizing churchgoers for running for low-level local office. And that gave them a huge crop of politicians who worked their way up mm-hmm. the ladder. And you know, they are harvesting the fruits of that right now. And there's no yeah. reason that our side cannot replicate that. So, I mean, the big things are buy the book. I joke about it. I really don't care if you buy the book. Get it from your library. Tell your library to get it. Then read the book so you understand what is happening. You understand these arguments. You can deploy these arguments, because pointing to the Treaty of Tripoli is not enough. It's not going to win us this argument. It hasn't for the last 20 years. It's not going to now. So get the better arguments that I use in the book. Then join up on these groups, donate to them, but please join, run for office. Those are the big things really that people can do. And the final thing is, even if you don't want to run for office, like, you've got to get politically involved. I know there is a tendency towards despair right now, and that your voice doesn't matter, but your voice is the only thing that matters. I mean, the idea that politicians don't care what you think is, to me, just, when I hear people say that, it is mind-boggling. But literally the only thing that politicians care about is what you think. That is literally the only thing they care about. Make sure that you are not sitting quietly assuming that you are not going to have an impact if you speak out. Yeah, it may not go the way that you want it to, but that doesn't mean you didn't have an impact. And if you continue to, and you can motivate others to do the same, you will end up having an impact.
Yeah.
So those are my pieces of advice.
I have an old friend from high school that worked for Senator Ron Wyden for, I think, about almost 10 years. And he actually might have been a full 10 years. But so he was in the communications office, and one of the things they did was every single letter and every single phone call that came in, they had to log.
Yeah, it gets tallied, every one of them.
And Senator Wyden knew exactly what the people calling, whether they were from his state or not, and what their position was on it. And they always updated him on what was going on with those.
Yeah, no, I mean, and you know, we have a lot of contact with the congressional offices and people who are in that. Our legal director worked for here at FFRF, worked for a senator for a long time. And, you know, she likes to talk about how same kind of thing, like at the end of every single day, the senator would get briefed by, this is how many contacts we got today via phone. X percent of those calls were for this, whereas only two were against it. So, you know, everybody, there's an overwhelming majority of people are for this. And that has an impact. It, of course, it is going to have an impact on an elected official whose central concern is getting reelected, which means their central concern is your thoughts and your voice.
Yeah. And when you're talking about small local offices, there's a lot of those that end up being
unopposed
or just straight up vacant.
Yeah,
if you absolutely run for an empty seat on the irrigation district, yeah, it might just be the irrigation district, but it's elected office.
Yeah, it is. And you know, there are, I've written to irrigation districts before where they were having prayer before their meetings.
Yeah.
And it was somebody on the council, a local person who ran and got in touch with me and said, hey, this, I just joined this and this is happening. This doesn't seem right. Can you help out? Yeah, absolutely. We'll help out. So, I mean, that they, a local secular person running for that office, got in touch with us and we were able to have an impact. I mean, and that makes a difference. That really does make a difference.
Various people in the atheist community here in Boise, we were able to get the Ada County Highway District, when they proposed and then passed their invocation policy, we kept the pressure on and had the backing of a bunch of staff members at the highway district, got them to reverse the decision.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. I mean, you absolutely can have an impact, and bravo. That's fantastic work. And there's no reason that can't happen everywhere.
And even when the vote goes against you, that doesn't mean let up.
Yeah. No, I mean, and this is the thing, like it doesn't matter that the court declared the cross constitutional in one sense, because if we could get it together and get people on the board that manages that land, we could get it removed.
Yeah.
You know, there are other solutions. Justice Kavanaugh pointed this out in his concurrence in the case, and it felt absolutely absurd when he did it because of the way he's written about us in the past. But you know, it's not untrue. The example you just gave about, you know, getting that prayer policy rescinded is a perfect example of that. We, even if something is not illegal, that doesn't mean we can't stop it.
Right. All right. And if we're seeing stuff and we need help, how can we get in touch with FFRF and what can you do to help us?
If you see a state church violation, the Freedom From Religion Foundation is here to help you. You know, I mentioned our two goals are to separate and to educate, to keep state and church separate, to educate the public about non-believers. We will help you fight that violation, and there's a number of different ways that we can do that. We are happy to take it on our own. We'll keep your information confidential if you prefer, and work to stop the government from doing whatever it is that they are doing to violate the Constitution. And all you have to do is reach out to us. Our website is ffrf.org. That's where you can join us. It's only $40 a year to join. Please do. That's where you can report a state church violation. Please do that. And then you can also follow us on our social media for more news about the, you know, and to learn more about the work that FFRF is doing.
Yeah, and I know one case that I brought to you guys a few years back. My niece was going to a middle school, and we went for a family rafting trip, and the shuttle van driver was a local youth pastor who said he was going to be seeing her at lunch at school. And I called up FFRF, and they sent a letter to the district. The district had no idea what was going on and shut it down.
Yeah. And we're often able to stop these violations with a simple letter pointing out what the problem is. In the case you just mentioned, that does happen from time to time, where often actually where higher ups don't know that the principal or maybe a couple teachers are, you know, doing a little wink and a nod for the pastor at their local church and letting them in the back door. And we see that pretty regularly. So, you know, we can stop these things and we can do it to keep you anonymous. You know, you may not want to out your kid and make their life more difficult in the schools. So you come to us and we'll keep your name out of it and get it solved.
And is it when people are able to not be anonymous, does that make it more powerful?
I mean, I will say this, we are more successful. Our win rate is better when we have vocal local activists. So when we have people who are willing to back us up at, you know, if we're writing to a city council, for instance, about something they're doing, we are more likely to win on that issue if we have vocal local activists who are willing to show up and support us. Doesn't mean we always win. Doesn't mean we always win without going to court, but we are far more likely to.
And when you do have to go to court, do you have to have a named plaintiff?
Not always. No, we can't. We have taken a number of lawsuits under pseudonyms, Doe, okay. Jane Doe, John Doe, that kind of thing, to protect the identity. But it's rare, and people shouldn't even be. When you're initially reporting something to us, that's a concern. That's a long way down the road. A very small percentage of our cases go to court because we are able to solve them almost all without going to court.
Okay, so don't necessarily worry about that detail until you get there.
No, you should not, actually, that should not go into your calculation when you're deciding whether or not to report this to FFRF, because, you know, the chances of that happening are almost nil, and you will absolutely have the opportunity to say no long before we would ever get to that.
All right. And if people do need to reach out to FFRF, how can they do that?
I mean, the best way to do it, if you've got a complaint that you want to do, is go to ffrf.org. There's a tab that says legal, and then you click on that and then report a state church violation. Give us all the information you can. It makes it much easier for us to take action on it quickly. It's back to school time, so we tend to get a wave of complaints this year. You should hear from an attorney at FFRF pretty soon, but then we do triage the complaints as they come in. And, you know, if something has already happened, it's going to get a lower level of priority than something that's about to happen tomorrow at a kindergarten class, for instance. So bear with us while we're going through it, but we will get to your complaint and you will hear from us for sure. And then if people are interested in following me, I'm on social media too, Andrew L. Seidel, on all the usual places.
All right. And links to all of that will be in the show notes, as well as link to your book.
Yeah. And I hope everybody enjoys it. It was a labor of love over a long time.
Yeah. All right, Andrew, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it was my pleasure. It was a great conversation. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. Well, I hope you enjoyed the interview. If you want to come to Camp Nomad, but you can find more information at atheistnomads.com/camp. And if you want to contact us, you can always send us an email at contact@atheistnomads.com or use the feedback form at atheistnomads.com/contact, or leave us a message via SpeakPipe. And if you want to support the show, you can find out how at atheistnomads.com/donate. And we have various options to do so using Patreon, PodFan, or PayPal, which covers all of your options from a per episode, monthly, or one-time basis. And on occasion, we will also even take paper checks or cash. So we are always happy to get whatever support you're willing to send our way. That wraps it up for this week. Until next time, remember, not all those who wander are lost. Thank you for listening to another episode of Atheist Nomads. You can find show notes and contact information at atheistnomads.com. Follow us on Twitter at Atheist Nomads and like us on Facebook at facebook.com/atheistnomads. Please subscribe to the show in iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcatcher of choice. And while you're there, feel free to leave us a review. Theme music is courtesy of Sturdy Fred. Until next time, this has been the Atheist Nomads.